This is the third in a series of lectures on the classic clinical process that takes place in a patient-clinician interaction. The first two lectures discuss the process of gathering information, rearranging it into a conventional structure used in healthcare, and reorganizing it to make sense out of the data. That process concluded with a problem list. The next step is often to try to arrive at a specific diagnosis that can guide treatment. This is the subject of the current lecture. We concluded the previous lecture with the problem list that resulted from analysis of information gathered from a man with swelling in his ankles, depicted on this slide. On the left, we see some of the symptoms and signs that were found in the man organized into something of a problem list. On the right, we see the beginnings of a differential diagnosis. Let's take the weight gain and edema which the man reported. At the top right, we see that edema could be caused by conditions of different organ systems. Edema may result from heart disease, such as that caused by long-standing high blood pressure. It may result from liver disease, such as cirrhosis due to chronic alcoholism. It could also be a case of kidney disease, such as nephrotic syndrome. Or in some countries, edema like this might be the result of severe malnutrition, though this form would be rare in the United States. Moving down the slide, we see the differential diagnosis for shortness of breath or dyspnea. Again, this may result from diseases of many organ systems: heart disease, lung disease, anemia or low blood count, physical restriction due to a large abdomen in obesity, or deconditioning due to inactivity. As we examine these lists, we can see that some conditions or categories of conditions exist on both lists, and these may be clues to what is wrong with this man. We also see that some data that speaks for certain guesses about the condition in question, but this kind of reasoning will only take us so far to reach an accurate diagnosis. We need some rules and procedures that will help us think about the problem in a more structured way. On this slide are listed some categories of techniques or processes that are used by clinicians to help them think about diagnoses. These include systematic approaches that basically run through every organ system, such as the mnemonic Vindicate. Another category of approach is to use the anatomic organization, in which one uses one's knowledge of anatomy to think through the potential causes of a problem. A third approach is pathophysiologic, where one uses one's knowledge of physiology to think through the potential causes of a problem. A very common approach that is employed is pattern recognition, which can be used when one has sufficient experience with the condition to recognize that a case fits it or does not. We also use mnemonics, memory devices that may have nothing to do with the content but help us remember useful groupings. The mnemonic P.T. Barnum Loves Kids reminds us that the causes of cancer that spread to bone include prostate, thyroid, breast, lung, and kidney. Clinicians make a lot of use of heuristics, such as the old saying, "When you hear hoofbeats, look for horses, not zebras," which reminds us to always think of the common things first. Though not generally used formally, clinicians make informal use of techniques based on Bayes' theorem, which can calculate the probability of a condition based on the findings that are present and the background probability of the condition. Finally, we can use the temporal patterns of illness to help us understand the underlying pathophysiology. The same symptoms occurring over moments are likely to be caused by a different process than these symptoms when they evolve over many months. More on this later. Here are two examples of systematic approaches that help us brainstorm to expand our differential diagnosis. On the left is the mnemonic Vindicate, which helps us remember vascular, infectious, neoplastic, drug-induced, and other causes of disease. Within each of these categories, we can think of subcategories of groups For example, once we think of infectious diseases, we can consider viral diseases, bacterial diseases, parasitic, fungal, and so forth. These groupings take advantage of fundamental properties of human memory, enabling us to remember far more individual items when they are grouped in meaningful ways than we could remember in a simple list. On the right half of this slide is another systematic approach based not on the process but on the organ system involved. Neurologic diseases, diseases of the cardiovascular system, diseases of the pulmonary system, and so forth. Clinicians may use either of or both of these approaches to help them think through a case when a comprehensive approach is needed. This slide shows a cross-section of the anatomy of the chest. It illustrates another approach to differential diagnosis, which is to use the underlying anatomy to help a clinician think of all the causes of a particular symptom or syndrome. For example, chest pain can be the result of a disorder in any of the structures depicted in this cross-section, from the skin at the very outside all the way through to the esophagus and windpipe in the middle. Simply by thinking through this anatomy, one can generate a fairly complete differential diagnosis of all the things that might cause chest pain. Similar to using the anatomy, we can use physiology. This slide illustrates how a differential diagnosis may be generated by recalling the underlying physiology involved. In this case, when evaluating a patient with jaundice, a clinician may recall all the steps in the formation and excretion of bilirubin from hemoglobin in the red blood cell to the excretion of urobilinogen. By remembering all of the steps involved, a clinician can reconstitute a fairly complete differential diagnosis for this problem in cases where such a comprehensive approach is needed. More often, rather than a highly detailed differential diagnosis, clinicians will think in terms of the major groups: disorders of red blood cells, disorders of the liver, disorders of the gallbladder and biliary system, and so forth. By thinking first in terms of these large groups, the clinician may pursue further information to simplify the problem by eliminating entire categories of disease. In neurologic diagnosis especially, clinicians use the topographic pattern, the temporal pattern, and the clinical context. By topographic pattern, we mean mapping the symptoms to the specific location in the brain or nervous system that is responsible for that function. By temporal pattern, we mean looking at the pace at which the symptoms appear or resolve to help us understand the underlying pathophysiological processes that might be causing the process. Finally, the clinical context helps us understand what non-neurologic process may be causing the condition. A patient who has a fever is a little more likely to have infection, while a patient with comorbid illness such as valvular heart disease is more likely to have a heart condition as the cause, and a person who smokes is more likely to have cancer as the cause. This slide illustrates the use of topography in neurologic diagnosis. On the left is the picture of the brain showing the part of the brain that's responsible for motor function and sensory function. On the right is a cross-section of this area, which shows how sensation and movement of specific parts of the body are controlled by specific regions of the brain. We can correlate the patient's symptoms and signs on physical examination with the exact location of the nervous system which might be responsible for these symptoms. The same is true for diseases of the nervous system that arise outside of the brain, such as in the spinal cord. This slide shows how we use the temporal pattern of symptoms in neurologic diagnosis. Given the exact same set of symptoms, for example, numbness and weakness in the right arm and the right side of the face, we can infer what kind of process might be involved by the pace at which these symptoms appear. Seizures, indicated in blue, are essentially an electrical process and take place over a matter of minutes. When a person's symptoms appear abruptly and then disappear within minutes, it may well have been a seizure. Vascular events, indicated on this slide in red, and include stroke, transient ischemic attack, or migraine, generally take place over minutes to hours. So the same symptoms, if they appear over minutes and last perhaps several hours, may be due to a vascular process. If these symptoms go away entirely, it may be a transient ischemic attack, indicated in the red dotted line. If some symptoms persist indefinitely with a permanent damage, then it is a stroke, indicated in the horizontal red line. When symptoms appear over many hours to days or even weeks, that suggests an infectious cause, indicated here in orange. A brain abscess, for example, might cause that same numbness and tingling and weakness, but evolving over several hours or days. If these same symptoms appeared over many, many months, in a pattern of more or less relentless progression, then they may be due to a neoplasm or cancerous growth, indicated here in green. Neurodegenerative diseases, indicated in dotted black, occur slowly over many months or years. An example would be amyotrophic lateral sclerosis, or Lou Gehrig's disease. Finally, some conditions are characterized by waxing and waning symptoms that come and go, superimposed on an underlying, slowly progressive worsening. This suggests a disease such as multiple sclerosis, indicated here in gray. So we can see that neurologic diagnosis depends on combining the topography of the condition, indicating which part of the brain is involved, with the temporal pattern, which suggests what kind of process may be causing the trouble.
Another approach that is commonly used by clinicians for more efficient diagnostic reasoning is to employ heuristics, or rules of thumb. Listed here are three: err on the side of life, which suggests emphasizing those conditions which are most life-threatening or most conducive to treatment. When you hear hoofbeats, think of horses, not zebras, which suggests that we should think about common diseases first because they are so much more likely to occur. And you're more likely to see an uncommon case of a common disease than an uncommon disease, which reminds us again that even when it looks like we're seeing a rare condition, in terms of probability, it's more likely to be one of the common ones. Now, there are drawbacks to using heuristics in that they can lead to some cognitive errors and biases, but their strengths are that they are fast and frugal, enabling us to get an appropriate working diagnosis with a minimum of resources, including time and attention. Although not used much in day-to-day clinical work, mathematical approaches to assist with diagnosis are employed informally in the clinic and in formal ways in decision support systems and guidelines. Bayes' theorem has been widely employed to help us determine the probability of a condition given its prevalence in the population and the findings that are present in a given patient. We use the mnemonics spin and snout to remind us that the specificity of a test tells us how useful it is for ruling a condition in, while the sensitivity of a test tells us how useful it is for ruling a condition out. The illustration on the right shows the mathematics of Bayes' theorem and an example of data for a given diagnostic test plotted in what is called a receiver operating characteristic curve. These curves that are used in this analysis are beyond the scope of this lecture, but are worth pursuing to better understand how this kind of analysis can be used to enhance diagnosis. Mathematical approaches are also used to derive decision rules, which then become simple bedside rules for determining the likelihood of conditions. Two examples are Wells' criteria for determining the likelihood of a pulmonary embolus or blood clot. Many clinicians use pocket calculators or online calculators to determine the Wells score in helping them decide whether to do further testing for pulmonary embolus. Similarly, there are simple scoring rules that help us determine the probability of streptococcal pharyngitis or bacterial sinusitis, which can lead to more appropriate antibiotic prescribing. Finally, formal decision analysis is applied to clinical problems, not often in the clinic or at the bedside, but to set policy, create guidelines, and so forth. These techniques, of course, are especially amenable to providing decision support with computer systems, since calculations which may be difficult to do on the fly in one's head are trivial for the computer if the correct data are available.